Vic sat silent, looking at his congealing sandwich and thinking. It was totally unfair. But he could live with unfairness. What really hurt was the whole situation's crazed absurdity. It had blown up out of a clear sky like a killer tornado that lays a zigzagging trail of destruction and then disappears. He and Roger and AdWorks itself were apt to be numbered among the fatalities no matter what they did. He could read it on Roger's round face, which had not looked so pallidly serious since he and Althea had lost their boy Timothy to the crib death syndrome when the infant was only 9 days old. 3 weeks after that happened, Roger had broken down and wept, his hands plastered to his fat face in a kind of terrible, hopeless sorrow that had squeezed Vic's heart into his throat. That had been bad. But the incipient panic he saw in Roger's eyes now was bad, too. Tornadoes blew out of nowhere in the advertising business from time to time. A big outfit like the Ellison Agency, which billed in the millions, could withstand them. A little one, like AdWorks, just couldn't. They had been carrying one basket with a lot of little eggs in it, and another basket with one big egg, the Sharp account. And it now remained to be seen whether the big egg had been lost entirely, or if it could at least be scrambled. None of it had been their fault, but ad agencies make lovely whipping boys. Vic and Roger had teamed naturally together ever since their first joint effort at the Ellison Agency 6 years ago. Vic, tall and skinny and rather quiet, had formed the perfect yin for Roger Breakstone's fat, happy, and extroverted yang. They had clicked on a personal basis and on a professional one. That first assignment had been a minor one, to submit a magazine ad campaign for United Cerebral Palsy. They had come up with a stark black-and-white ad that showed a small boy in huge, cruel leg braces standing in foul territory by the first base line of a little league ball field. A New York Mets cap was perched on his head, and his expression, Roger had always maintained that it had been the boy's expression which sold the ad, wasn't sad at all. It was simply dreamy. Almost happy, in fact. The copy read simply, "Billy Bellamy is never going to bat cleanup." Beneath, "Billy has cerebral palsy." Beneath that, smaller type, "Give us a hand, huh?" CP donations had taken a noticeable leap. Good for them, good for Vic and Roger. The team of Trenton and Breakstone had been off and running. Half a dozen successful campaigns had followed, Vic dealing most commonly with broad-scope conception, Roger dealing with actual execution. For the Sony Corporation, a picture of a man sitting cross-legged on the median strip of a 16-lane superhighway in a business suit, a big Sony radio on his lap, a seraphic smile on his kisser. The copy read, "Police Band, The Rolling Stones, Vivaldi, Mike Wallace, The Kingston Trio, Paul Harvey, Patti Smith, Jerry Falwell." And below that, "Hello, L.A." For the Voigt people, makers of swim equipment, an ad that showed a man who was the utter antithesis of the Miami Beach Boy, standing arrogantly hip-shot on the golden beach of some tropical paradise. The model was a 50-year-old man with tattoos, a beer belly, slab-muscled arms and legs, and a puckered scar high across one thigh. In his arms, this battered soldier of fortune was cradling a pair of Voigt swim fins. "Mister," the copy for this one read, "I dive for a living. I don't mess around." There was a lot more underneath, stuff Roger always referred to as the blah-blah, but the copy set in boldface was the real hooker. Vic and Roger had wanted it to read, "I don't screw around," but they hadn't been able to sell the Voigt people on that. Pity, Vic was fond of saying over drinks. They could have sold a lot more swim fins. Then there was Sharp. The Sharp Company of Cleveland had stood 12th in the Great American Bake Stakes when Old Man Sharp reluctantly came to the Ellison Agency in New York after more than 20 years with a hometown ad agency. Sharp had been bigger than Nabisco before World War II, the old man was fond of pointing out. His son was just as fond of pointing out that World War II had ended 30 years ago. The account, on a 6-month trial basis at first, had been handed over to Vic Trenton and Roger Breakstone. At the end of the trial period, Sharp had vaulted from 12th in the cookies, cakes, and cereals market to 9th. A year later, when Vic and Roger pulled up stakes and moved to Maine to open up their own business, the Sharp Company had climbed to 7th. Their campaign had been a sweeping one. For Sharp Cookies, Vic and Roger had developed the Cookie Sharpshooter, a bumbling Western peace officer whose 6 guns shot cookies instead of bullets, courtesy of the special effects people. Chocolate chippers in some spots, ginger snappies in others. Oh, those oatmeals in still others. The spots always ended with the sharpshooter standing sadly in a pile of cookies with his guns out. Well, the bad guys got away, he'd tell millions of Americans every day or so, but I got the cookies. Best cookies in the West, or anywhere else, I reckon. The sharpshooter bites into a cookie. His expression suggests that he is experiencing the gastronomic equivalent of a boy's first orgasm. Fade out. For the prepared cakes, 16 different varieties ranging from pound to crumb to cheese, there was what Vic called the George and Gracie spot. We fade in on George and Gracie leaving a posh dinner party where the buffet table groans with every possible delicacy. We dissolve to a dingy little cold water flat, starkly lighted. George is sitting at a plain kitchen table with a checked tablecloth. Gracie takes a sharp pound cake, or cheesecake, or crumb cake, from the freezer of their old refrigerator and sets it on the table. They are both still in their evening clothes. They smile into each other's eyes with warmth and love and understanding, two people who are utterly in sync with each other. Fade to these words on black. Sometimes all you want is a sharp cake. Not a word spoken in the entire spot. That one had won a Clio. As had the Sharp serial professor, hailed in the trades as the most responsible advertisement ever produced for children's programming. Vic and Roger had considered it their crowning achievement. But now it was the Sharp serial professor who had come back to haunt them. Played by a character actor in late middle age, the Sharp serial professor was a low-key and daringly adult advertisement in a sea of animated kiddie vid ads selling bubblegum, adventure toys, dolls, action figures, and rival cereals. The ad faded in on a deserted 4th or 5th grade classroom. A scene Saturday morning viewers of the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour and the Drac Pack could readily identify with. The Sharp serial professor was wearing a suit, a V-necked sweater, and a shirt open at the collar. Both in looks and in speech, he was mildly authoritarian. Vic and Roger had talked to some 40 teachers and half a dozen child psychiatrists and had discovered that this was the sort of parental role model that the majority of kids feel most comfortable with, and the sort that so few actually have in their homes. The serial professor was sitting on a teacher's desk, hinting at some informality, the soul of a real pal hidden somewhere beneath that gray-green tweed, the young viewer might assume. But he spoke slowly and gravely. He did not command. He did not talk down. He did not wheedle. He did not cajole or extol. He spoke to the millions of T-shirted, cereal-slurping, cartoon-watching Saturday morning viewers as though they were real people. "Good morning, children," the professor said quietly. "This is a commercial for cereal. Listen to me carefully, please. I know a lot about cereals because I'm the Sharp Cereal Professor. Sharp Cereals, Twinkles, Cocoa Bears, Bran 16, and Sharp All Grain Blend are the best-tasting cereals in America. And they're good for you. A beat of silence. And then the Sharp Cereal Professor grinned. And when he grinned, you knew there was the soul of a real pal in there. Believe me, because I know. Your mom knows. I just thought you'd like to know, too. A young man came into the ad at that point, and he handed the Sharp Cereal Professor a bowl of Twinkles or Cocoa Bears or whatever. The Sharp Cereal Professor dug in, then looked straight into every living room in the country and said, "Nope, nothing wrong here." Old Man Sharp hadn't cared for that last line, or the idea that anything could be wrong with one of his cereals. Eventually, Vic and Roger had worn him down, but not with rational arguments. Making ads was not a rational business. You often did what felt right, but that didn't mean you could understand why it felt right. Both Vic and Roger felt that the professor's final line had a power which was both simple and enormous. Coming from the cereal professor, it was the final total comfort, a complete security blanket. "I'll never hurt you," it implied. In a world where parents get divorced, where older kids sometimes beat the shit out of you for no rational reason, where the rival little league team sometimes racks the crap out of your pitching, where the good guys don't always win like they do on TV, where you don't always get invited to the good birthday party, in a world where so much goes wrong, there will always be Twinkles and Cocoa Bears and All Grain Blend. And they'll always taste good. Nope, nothing wrong here. With a little help from Sharp's son, later on, Roger said, you would have believed the kid thought the ad up and wrote it himself, the cereal professor concept was approved and saturated Saturday morning TV, plus such weekly syndicated programs as Star Blazers, U.S. of Archie, Hogan's Heroes, and Gilligan's Island. Sharp cereals surged even more powerfully than the rest of the Sharp line, and the cereal professor became an American institution. His tagline, "Nope, nothing wrong here," became one of those national catchphrases, meaning roughly the same thing as "stay cool" and "no sweat." When Vic and Roger decided to go their own way, they had observed strict protocol and had not gone to any of their previous clients until their connections with the Ellison Agency were formally and amicably severed. Their first 6 months in Portland had been a scary pressure cooker time for all of them. Vic and Donna's boy Tad was only a year old. Donna, who missed New York badly, was by turns sullen, petulant, and just plain scared. Roger had an old ulcer, a battle scar from his years in the Big Apple advertising wars, and when he and Althea lost the baby, the ulcer had flared up again, turning him into a closet Jellusil chugger. Althea bounced back as well as possible under the circumstances, Vic thought. It was Donna who pointed out to him that placid Althea's single weak drink before dinner had turned into two before and three after. The two couples had vacationed in Maine, separately and together. But neither Vic nor Roger had realized how many doors are initially closed to folks who have moved in, as Mainers say, from out of state. They would indeed have gone under, as Roger pointed out, if Sharp hadn't decided to stay with them. And at the company's Cleveland headquarters, positions had done an ironic flip-flop. Now it was the old man who wanted to stick with Vic and Roger, and it was the kid, by this time 40 years old, who wanted to jettison them, arguing with some logic that it would be madness to hand their account over to a 2-bit ad agency 600 miles north of the New York pulse beat. The fact that AdWorks was affiliated with a New York market analysis firm cut zero ice with the kid, as it had cut zero ice with the other firms for which they had put together campaigns in the past few years. "If loyalty was toilet paper," Roger had said bitterly, "we'd be hard-pressed to wipe our asses, old buddy." But Sharp had come along, providing the margin they had so desperately needed. "We may do with an ad agency here in town for 40 years, old man Sharp said. "And if those two boys want to move out of that Christless city, they're just showing good old common sense." That was that. The old man had spoken. The kid shut up. And for the last 2.5 years, the cookie sharpshooter had gone on shooting. George and Gracie had gone on eating Sharp cakes in their cold water flat, and the Sharp cereal professor had gone on telling kids that there was nothing wrong here. Actual spot production was handled by a small independent studio in Boston. The New York market analysis firm went on doing its thing competently, and 3 or 4 times a year either Vic or Roger flew to Cleveland to confer with Carol Sharp and his kid, said kid now going decidedly gray around the temples. All the rest of the client-agency intercourse was handled by the U.S. Post Office and Ma Bell. The process was perhaps strange, certainly cumbersome, but it seemed to work fine. Then along came Red Raspberry Zingers. Vic and Roger had known about Zingers for some time, of course, although it had only gone on the general market some 2 months ago, in April of 1980. Most of the Sharp cereals were lightly sweetened or not sweetened at all. All Grain Blend, Sharp's entry in the natural cereal arena, had been quite successful. Red Raspberry Zingers, however, was aimed at a segment of the market with a sweeter tooth. At those prepared cereal eaters who bought such cereals as Count Chocula, Frankenberry, Lucky Charms, and similar pre-sweetened breakfast foods which were somewhere in the twilight zone between cereal and candy. In the late summer and early fall of 1979, Zingers had been successfully test-marketed in Boise, Idaho, Scranton, Pennsylvania, and in Roger's adopted Maine hometown of Bridgeton. Roger had told Vic with a shudder that he wouldn't let the twins near it with a 10-foot pole. Although he had been pleased when Althea told him the kids had clamored for it when they saw it shelved at Giger's Market.
"It's got more sugar than whole grain in it, and it looks like the side of a fire barn."
Vic had nodded and replied innocently enough, with no sense of prophecy, "The first time I looked in one of those boxes, I thought it was full of blood."
"So, what do you think?" Roger repeated.
He had made it halfway through his sandwich as Vic reviewed the dismal train of events in his mind. He was becoming more and more sure that in Cleveland, old man Sharp and his aging kid were looking again to shoot the messenger for the message.
"Guess we better try."
Roger clapped him on the shoulder.
"My man," he said. "Now, eat up."
But Vic wasn't hungry. The two of them had been invited to Cleveland to attend an emergency meeting that was to be held 3 weeks after the 4th of July. A good many of the Sharp regional sales managers and executives were vacationing, and it would take at least that long to get them all together. One of the items on the agenda had to do directly with AdWorks, an assessment of the association to this point, the letter had said. Which meant, Vic assumed, that the kid was using the Zingers debacle to dump them at last. About 3 weeks after Red Raspberry Zingers went national, enthusiastically, if gravely, pitched by the Sharp cereal professor, "Nope, nothing wrong here," the first mother had taken her little one to the hospital, nearly hysterical, and sure the child was bleeding internally. The little girl, victim of nothing more serious than a low-grade virus, had thrown up what her mother had first believed to be a huge amount of blood. Nope, nothing wrong here. That had been in Iowa City, Iowa. The following day, there had been 7 more cases. The day after, 24. In all cases, the parents of children afflicted with vomiting or diarrhea had rushed the kids to the hospital, believing them to be suffering internal bleeding. After that, the cases had skyrocketed, first into the hundreds, then into the thousands. In none of these cases had the vomiting and/or diarrhea been caused by the cereal, but that was generally overlooked in the growing furor. Nope, not a single thing wrong here. The cases had spread west to east. The problem was the food dye that gave Zingers its zingy red color. The dye itself was harmless, but that was also mostly overlooked. Something had gone wrong, and instead of assimilating the red dye, the human body simply passed it along. The goofed-up dye had only gotten into one batch of cereal, but it had been a whopper of a batch. A doctor told Vic that if a child who had just died after ingesting a big bowl of red raspberry Zingers were the subject of an autopsy, the postmortem would reveal a digestive tract as red as a stop sign. The effect was strictly temporary, but that had been overlooked, too. Roger wanted them to go down with all guns firing if they were to go down. He had proposed marathon conferences with the Image Eye people in Boston who actually did the spots. He wanted to talk with the Sharp Cereal professor himself, who had gotten so involved with his role that he was mentally and emotionally torn up over what had happened. Then on to New York to talk to the marketing people. Most important, it would be almost 2 weeks at Boston's Ritz-Carlton and at New York's UN Plaza. 2 weeks Vic and Roger would spend mostly in each other's hip pockets, digesting the input and brainstorming as they had in the old days. What Roger hoped would come out of it was a rebound campaign that would blow the socks off both Old Man Sharp and the kid. Instead of going to Cleveland with their necks shaved for the drop of the guillotine blade, they would show up with battle plans drawn to reverse the effects of the Zinger snafu. That was the theory. In practice, they both realized that their chances were about as good as they were for a pitcher who deliberately sets out to throw a no-hitter. Vic had other problems. For the last 8 months or so, he had sensed that he and his wife were drifting slowly apart. He still loved her, and he damn near idolized Tad. But things had gone from a little uneasy to bad, and he sensed that there were worse things and worse times waiting. Just over the horizon, maybe. This trip, a grand tour from Boston to New York to Cleveland, coming at what should have been their at-home season, their doing-things-together season, was maybe not such a hot idea. When he looked at her face lately, he saw a stranger lurking just below its planes and angles and curves. And the question, it played over and over in his mind on nights when he wasn't able to sleep. And such nights had become more common lately. Had she taken a lover? They sure didn't sleep together much anymore. Had she done it? He hoped it wasn't so. But what did he think? Really? Tell the truth, Mr. Trenton, or you'll be forced to pay the consequences. He wasn't sure. He didn't want to be sure. He was afraid that if he became sure, the marriage would end. He was still completely gone on her, had never so much as considered an extramarital fling, and he could forgive her much, but not being cuckolded in his own home. You don't want to wear those horns. They grow out of your ears, and kids laugh at the funny man on the street. He... What? Vic said, emerging from his reverie. I missed it, Raj. I said that goddamn red cereal, unquote. My exact words. Yeah, Vic said. I'll drink to that. Roger raised his Pilsner glass. Do it, he said. Vic did. Gary Pervier sat out on his weedy front lawn at the bottom of Seven Oaks Hill on Town Road Number 3 about a week after Vic and Roger's depressing luncheon meeting at the Yellow Sub, drinking a screwdriver that was 25% bird's-eye frozen orange juice and 75% pop-off vodka. He sat in the shade of an elm that was in the last stages of rampant Dutch elm disease, his bottom resting against the frayed straps of a Sears Roebuck mail-order lawn chair that was in the last stages of useful service. He was drinking Popoff because Popoff was cheap. Gary had purchased a large supply of it in New Hampshire, where booze was cheaper, on his last liquor run. Popoff was cheap in Maine, but it was dirt cheap in New Hampshire, a state which took its stand for the finer things in life, a fat state lottery, cheap booze, cheap cigarettes, and tourist attractions like Santa's Village and Six Gun City. New Hampshire was a great old place. The lawn chair had slowly settled into his run-to-riot lawn, digging deep divots. The house behind the lawn had also run to riot. It was a gray, paint-peeling, roof-sagging shambles. Shutters hung. The chimney hooked at the sky like a drunk trying to get up from a tumble. Shingles blown off in the previous winter's last big storm still hung limply from some of the branches of the dying elm. "It ain't the Taj Mahal," Gary sometimes said. "But who gives a shit?" Gary was, on this swelteringly hot late June day, as drunk as a coot. This was not an uncommon state of affairs with him. He did not know Roger Breakstone from shit. He did not know Vic Trenton from shit. He didn't know Donna Trenton from shit, and if he had known her, he wouldn't have given a shit if the visiting team was throwing line drives into her catcher's mitt. He did know the Cambers and their dog Cujo. The family lived up the hill at the end of Town Road Number 3. He and Joe Camber did a good deal of drinking together, and in a rather foggy fashion, Gary realized that Joe Camber was already a goodly way down the road to alcoholism. It was a road Gary himself had toured extensively. "Just a good-for-nothing drunk, and I don't give a shit," Gary told the birds and the shingles in the diseased elm. He tipped his glass. He farted. He squatted a bug. Sunlight and shadow dappled his face. Behind the house, a number of disemboweled cars had almost disappeared in the tall weeds. The ivy which grew on the west side of his house had gone absolutely apeshit, almost covering it. One window peeked out, barely, and on sunny days it glittered like a dirty diamond. 2 years ago, in a drunken frenzy, Gary had uprooted a bureau from one of the upstairs rooms and had thrown it out a window. He could not remember why now. He had reglazed the window himself because it had let in one crotch of a draft come winter, but the bureau rested exactly where it had fallen. One drawer was popped out like a tongue. In 1944, when Gary Pervier had been 20, he had single-handedly taken a German pillbox in France, and following that exploit had led the remains of his squad 10 miles farther before collapsing with the 6 bullet wounds he had suffered in his charge of the machine gun emplacement. For this, he had been awarded one of his grateful country's highest honors, the Distinguished Service Cross. In 1968, he had gotten Buddy Torgerson down in Castle Falls to turn the medal into an ashtray. Buddy had been shocked. Gary told Buddy he would have gotten him to make it into a toilet bowl so he could shit in it, but it wasn't big enough. Buddy spread the story, and maybe that had been Gary's intention. Or maybe it hadn't. Either way, it had driven the local hippies crazy with admiration. In the summer of 68, most of these hippies were on vacation in the Lakes region with their wealthy parents before returning to their colleges in September, where they were apparently studying up on protest, pot, and pussy. After Gary had his DSC turned into an ashtray by Buddy Torgerson, who did custom welding in his spare time and who worked days down to the Castle Falls Esso, they were all Exxon stations now, and Gary Pervier didn't give a shit. A version of the story found its way into the Castle Rock Call. The story was written by a local yokel reporter who construed the act as an anti-war gesture. That was when the hippies started to show up at Gary's place on Town Road Number 3. Most of them wanted to tell Gary he was far out. Some of them wanted to tell him he was some kind of heavy. A few wanted to tell him he was too fucking much. Gary showed them all the same thing, which was his Winchester 30-06. He told them to get off his property. As far as he was concerned, they were all a bunch of long-haired, muff-diving, crab-crawling, asshole, pinko fucksticks. He told them he didn't give a shit if he blew their guts from Castle Rock to Freiburg. After a while, they stopped coming, and that was the end of the DSC affair. One of those German bullets had taken Gary Pervier's right testicle off. A medic had found most of it splattered across the seat of his GI-issue underwear. Most of the other one survived, and sometimes he could still get a pretty respectable bone on. Not, he had frequently told Joe Camber, that he gave much of a shit one way or the other. His grateful country had given him the Distinguished Service Cross. A grateful hospital staff in Paris had discharged him in February 1945 with an 80% disability pension and a gold-plated monkey on his back. A grateful hometown gave him a parade on the 4th of July 1945. By then he was 21 instead of 20, able to vote, his hair graying around the temples, and he felt all of 700, thank you very much. The grateful town selectmen had remanded the property taxes on the Pervier place in perpetuity. That was good, because he would have lost it 20 years ago otherwise. He had replaced the morphine he could no longer obtain with high-tension booze, and had then proceeded to get about his life's work, which was killing himself as slowly and as pleasantly as he could. Now, in 1980, he was 56 years old, totally gray, and meaner than a bull with a jackhandle up its ass. About the only three living creatures he could stand were Joe Camber, his boy Brett, and Brett's big St. Bernard, Cujo. He tilted back in the decaying lawn chair, almost went over on his back, and used up some more of his screwdriver. The screwdriver was in a glass he had gotten free from a McDonald's restaurant. There was some sort of purple animal on the glass, something called a grimace. Gary ate a lot of his meals at the Castle Rock McDonald's, where you could still get a cheap hamburger. Hamburgers were good, but as for the grimace and Mayor McCheese and Monsieur Ronald fucking McDonald, Gary Pervier didn't give a shit for any of them. A broad, tawny shape was moving through the high grass to his left, and a moment later, Cujo, on one of his rambles, emerged into Gary's tattered front yard. He saw Gary and barked once, politely. Then he came over, wagging his tail.
"Cujo, you old son of a whore," Gary said.
He put his screwdriver down and began digging methodically through his pockets for dog biscuits. He always kept a few on hand for Cujo, who was one of your old-fashioned, dyed-in-the-wool good dogs. He found a couple in his shirt pocket and held them up.
"Sit, boy. Sit up."
No matter how low or how mean he was feeling, the sight of that 200-pound dog sitting up like a rabbit never failed to tickle him. Cujo sat up, and Gary saw a short but ugly-looking scratch healing on the dog's muzzle. Gary tossed him the biscuits, which were shaped like bones, and Cujo snapped them effortlessly out of the air. He dropped one between his forepaws and began to gnaw the other one.
"Good dog," Gary said, reaching out to pat Cujo's head. "Good."
Cujo began to growl, deep in his throat. It was a rumbling, almost reflective sound. He looked up at Gary, and there was something cold and speculative in the dog's eyes that gave Gary a chill. He took his hand back to himself quickly. A dog as big as Cujo was nothing to get screwing around with.
Not unless you wanted to spend the rest of your life wiping your ass with a hook.
"What's got into you, boy?" Gary asked.
He had never heard Cujo growl, not in all the years the Cambers had had him. To tell the truth, he wouldn't have believed old Cuj had a growl in him.
Cujo wagged his tail a little bit and came over to Gary to be patted, as if ashamed of his momentary lapse.
"Hey, that's more like it," Gary said, ruffling the big dog's fur.
It had been one scorcher of a week, and more coming, according to George Mira, who had heard it from Aunt Evie Chalmers. He supposed that was it. Dogs felt the heat even more than people did, and he guessed there was no rule against a mutt getting testy once in a while.
But it sure had been funny hearing Cujo growl like that.
If Joe Camber had told him, Gary wouldn't have believed it.
"Go get your other biscuit," Gary said, and pointed.
Cujo turned around, went to the biscuit, picked it up, mouthed it, a long string of saliva depending from his mouth, and then dropped it. He looked at Gary apologetically.
"You? Turning down chow?" Gary said unbelievingly. "You?"
Cujo picked up the dog biscuit again and ate it.
"That's better," Gary said. "A little heat ain't gonna kill ya. Ain't gonna kill me either, but it bitches the shit out of my hemorrhoids. Well, I don't give a shit if they get as big as fucking golf balls, you know it?"
He swatted a mosquito. Cujo lay down beside Gary's chair as Gary picked up his screwdriver again. It was almost time to go in and freshen it up, as the country club cunts said.
"Freshen up my ass," Gary said.
He gestured at the roof of his house, and a sticky mixture of orange juice and vodka trickled down his sunburned, scrawny arm.
"Look at that chimbley, Cujo guy. Falling right the fuck down. And you know what? I don't give a shit. The whole place could fall flat, and I wouldn't fat sideways to a dime, you know that?"
Cujo thumped his tail a little. He didn't know what this man was saying, but the rhythms were familiar and the patterns were soothing. These polemics had gone on a dozen times a week since, well, as far as Cujo was concerned, since forever. Cujo liked this man, who always had food. Just lately, Cujo didn't seem to want food. But if the man wanted him to eat, he would. Then he could lie here, as he was now, and listen to the soothing talk. All in all, Cujo didn't feel very well. He hadn't growled at the man because he was hot, but simply because he didn't feel good. For a moment there, just a moment, he had felt like biting the man.
"Got your nose in the brambles, looks like," Gary said. "What was you after? Woodchuck? Rabbit?"
Cujo thumped his tail a little. Crickets sang in the rampant bushes. Behind the house, honeysuckle grew in a wild drift, calling the somnolent bees of a summer afternoon. Everything in Cujo's life should have been right, but somehow it wasn't. He just didn't feel good at all.
"I don't even give a shit if all that Georgia redneck's teeth fall out, and all of Ray Gunn's teeth, too," Gary said, and stood up unsteadily.
The lawn chair fell over and collapsed itself. If you had guessed that Gary Pervier didn't give a shit, you would have been right.
"Excuse me, boy."
He went inside and built himself another screwdriver. The kitchen was a buzzing, fly-blown horror of split-open green garbage bags, empty cans, and empty liquor bottles. When Gary came back out again, fresh drink in hand, Cujo had left.
On the last day of June, Donna Trenton came back from downtown Castle Rock. The locals called it Down Street, but at least she hadn't picked up that particular Mainism yet, where she had dropped Tad off at his afternoon day camp and picked up a few groceries at the Agway Market. She was hot and tired, and the sight of Steve Kemp's battered Ford Econoline van with the gaudy desert murals painted on the sides suddenly turned her furious. Anger had simmered all day. Vic had told her about the impending trip at breakfast, and when she had protested being left alone with Tad for what might be 10 days or 2 weeks or God only knew, he made it clear to her exactly what the stakes were. He had thrown a scare into her, and she didn't like to be frightened. Up until this morning, she had treated the Red Raspberry Zingers affair as a joke, a rather good one at Vic and Roger's expense. She had never dreamed that such an absurd thing could have such serious consequences. Then Tad had been scratchy about going off to the day camp, complaining that a bigger boy had pushed him down last Friday. The bigger boy's name was Stanley Dobson, and Tad was afraid that Stanley Dobson might push him down again today. He had cried and clutched on to her when she got him to the American Legion field where the camp was held, and she'd had to pry his fingers loose from her blouse finger by finger, making her feel more like a Nazi than a mom. "You will go to day camp, ja? Ja, mein Mama." Sometimes Tad seemed so young for his age, so vulnerable. Weren't only children supposed to be precocious and resourceful? His fingers had been chocolatey and had left fingerprints on her blouse. They reminded her of the blood-stained handprints you sometimes saw in cheap detective magazines. To add to the fun, her pinto had started to act funny on the way home from the market, jerking and hitching as if it had an automotive case of hiccups. It had smoothed out after a bit, but what could happen once could happen again. And just to put a little icing on the cake, here was Steve Kemp. "Well, no bullshit," she muttered, grabbed her bag of groceries, and got out. A pretty dark-haired woman of 29, tall, gray-eyed. She somehow managed to look tolerably fresh in spite of the relentless heat, her tad-printed blouse, and academy gray shorts that felt pasted to her hips and fanny. She went up the steps quickly and into the house by the porch door. Steve was sitting in Vic's living room chair. He was drinking one of Vic's beers. He was smoking a cigarette, presumably one of his own. The TV was on, and the agonies of General Hospital played out there in living color. "The princess arrives," Steve said with the lopsided grin she had once found so charming and interestingly dangerous. "I thought you were never going to..." "I want you out of here, you son of a bitch," she said tonelessly, and went through into the kitchen. She put the grocery bag down on the counter and started putting things away. She could not remember when she had last been so angry, so furious that her stomach had tied itself in a gripping, groaning knot. One of the endless arguments with her mother, maybe. One of the real horror shows before she had gone away to school. When Steve came up behind her and slipped his tanned arms around her bare midriff, she acted with no thought at all. She brought her elbow back into his lower chest. Her temper was not cooled by the obvious fact that he had anticipated her. He played a lot of tennis, and her elbow felt as if it had struck a stone wall coated with a layer of hard rubber. She turned around and looked into his grinning, bearded face. She stood 5'11" and was an inch taller than Vic when she wore heels, but Steve was nearly 6'5". "Didn't you hear me? I want you out of here!" "Now, what for?" he asked. "The little one is off making beaded loincloths, or shooting apples off the head of counselors with his little bow and arrow, or whatever they do. And hubby is busting heavies at the office.
And now is the time for Castle Rock's prettiest housefrau and Castle Rock's resident poet and tennis bum to make all the bells of sexual congress chime in lovely harmony.
I see you parked out in the driveway, Donna said. Why not just tape a big sign to the side of your van? I'm fucking Donna Trenton, or something witty like that.
I've got every reason to park in the driveway, Steve said, still grinning. I've got that dresser in the back, stripped clean. Even as I wish you were yourself, my dear.
You can put it on the porch. I'll take care of it. While you're doing that, I'll write you a check. His smile faded a little. For the first time since she had come in, the surface charm slipped a little, and she could see the real person underneath. It was a person she didn't like at all. A person that dismayed her when she thought of him in connection with herself. She had lied to Vic, gone behind his back in order to go to bed with Steve Kemp. She wished that what she felt now could be something as simple as rediscovering herself, as after a nasty bout of fever, or rediscovering herself as Vic's mate. But when you took the bark off it, the simple fact was that Steve Kemp, publishing poet, itinerant furniture stripper and refinisher, chair caner, fair amateur tennis player, excellent afternoon lover, was a turd.
Be serious, he said.
Yeah, no one could reject handsome, sensitive Stephen Kemp, she said. It's got to be a joke.
Only it's not.
So what you do, handsome, sensitive Stephen Kemp, is put the dresser on the porch, get your check, and blow.
Don't talk to me like that, Donna.
His hand moved to her breast and squeezed. It hurt. She began to feel a little scared as well as angry. But hadn't she been a little scared all along? Hadn't that been part of the nasty, scuzzy little thrill of it? She slapped his hand away.
Don't you get on my case, Donna.
He wasn't smiling now.
It's too goddamn hot.
Me, on your case. You were here when I came in. Being frightened of him had made her angrier than ever. He wore a heavy black beard that climbed high on his cheekbones, and it occurred to her suddenly that although she had seen his penis close up, had had it in her mouth, she had never really seen what his face looked like.
What do you mean? He said. Is that you had a little itch, and now it's scratched, so fuck off, right? Who gives a crap about how I feel?
You're breathing on me, she said, and pushed him away to take the milk to the refrigerator. He was not expecting it this time. Her shove caught him off balance, and he actually stumbled back a step. His forehead was suddenly divided by lines, and a dark flush flared high on his cheekbones. She had seen him look this way on the tennis courts behind the Bridgeton Academy building sometimes, when he blew an easy point. She had watched him play several times, including two sets during which he had mopped up her panting, puffing husband with ease. And on the few occasions she had seen him lose, his reaction had made her extremely uneasy about what she had gotten into with him. He had published poems in over 24 little magazines, and a book, Chasing Sundown, had been published by an outfit in Baton Rouge called The Press Over the Garage. He had graduated from Drew in New Jersey. He held strong opinions on modern art, the upcoming nuclear referendum question in Maine, the films of Andy Warhol, and he took a double fault the way Tad took the news it was bedtime. Now he came after her, grabbed her shoulder, and spun her around to face him. The carton of milk fell from her hand and split open on the floor. "There, look at that," Donna said. "Nice going, hot shot."
"Listen, I'm not going to be pushed around. Do you? "You get out of here!" she screamed into his face. Her spittle sprayed his cheeks and his forehead. "What do I have to do to convince you? Do you need a picture? You're not welcome here. Go be God's gift to some other woman."
"You cheap, cock-teasing little bitch," he said. His voice was sullen, his face ugly. He didn't let go of her arm.
"And take the bureau with you. Pitch it in the dump."
She pulled free of him and got the wash rag from its place hung over the sink faucet. Her hands were trembling, her stomach was upset, and she was starting to get a headache. She thought that soon she would vomit. She got down on her hands and knees and began wiping up the spilt milk.
"Yeah, you think you're something," he said. "When did your crotch turn to gold?" "You loved it. You screamed for more."
"You've got the right tense anyway, champ," she said, not looking up.
Her hair hung in her face, and she liked it that way just fine. She didn't want him to see how pale and sick her face was. She felt as if someone had pushed her into a nightmare. She felt that if she looked at herself in a mirror at this moment, she would see an ugly, capering witch.
"Get out, Steve.
I'm not going to tell you again." "And what if I don't? You're going to call Sheriff Bannerman?" "Sure. Just say, 'Hi there, George. This is Mr. Businessman's wife, and the guy I've been screwing on the side won't leave. Would you please come on up here and roust him?'" "That what you're going to say?"
The fright went deep now. Before marrying Vic, she had been a librarian in the Westchester school system, and her own private nightmare had always been telling the kids for the third time, in her loudest speaking voice, to quiet down at once, please. When she did that, they always had, enough for her to get through the period at least. But what if they wouldn't? That was her nightmare. What if they absolutely wouldn't? What did that leave? The question scared her. It scared her that such a question should ever have to be asked, even to oneself, in the dark of night. She had been afraid to use her loudest voice, and had done so only when it became absolutely necessary, because that was where civilization came to an abrupt, screeching halt. That was the place where the tar turned to dirt. If they wouldn't listen when you used your very loudest voice, a scream became your only recourse. This was the same sort of fear. The only answer to the man's question, of course, was that she would scream if he came near her. But would she? "Go," she said in a lower voice. "Please. It's over."
"What if I decide it isn't? What if I decide to just rape you there on the floor in that damned spilt milk?"
She looked up at him through the tangle of hair. Her face was still pale and her eyes were too big, ringed with white flesh.
"Then you'll have a fight on your hands. And if I get a chance to tear your balls off or put one of your eyes out, I won't hesitate."
For just a moment before his face closed up, she thought he looked uncertain. He knew she was quick, in pretty good shape. He could beat her at tennis, but she made him sweat to do it. His balls and his eyes were probably safe, but she might very well put some furrows in his face. It was a question of how far he wanted to go. She smelled something thick and unpleasant in the air of her kitchen, some whiff of the jungle, and realized with dismay that it was a mixture of her fear and his rage. It was coming out of their pores.
"I'll take the bureau back to my shop," he said. Why don't you send your handsome hubby down for it, Donna? He and I can have a nice talk. About stripping.
He left then, pulling the door which communicated between the living room and the porch to behind him, almost hard enough to break the glass. A moment later, the engine of his van roared, settled into a ragged idle, and then dropped to a working pitch as he threw it in gear. He screeched his tires as he left. Donna finished wiping the milk up slowly, rising from time to time to wring out her rag in the stainless steel sink. She watched the threads of milk run down the drain. She was trembling all over, partly from reaction, partly from relief. She had barely heard Steve's implied threat to tell Vic. She could only think over and over again about the chain of events that had led to such an ugly scene. She sincerely believed she had drifted into her affair with Steve Kemp almost inadvertently. It was like an explosion of sewage from a buried pipe. A similar sewer pipe, she believed, ran beneath the neatly tended lawns of almost every marriage in America. She hadn't wanted to come to Maine, and had been appalled when Vic had sprung the idea on her. In spite of vacations there, and the vacations themselves might have reinforced the idea, she had thought of the state as a woodsy wasteland, a place where the snow drifted 20 feet high in the winters and people were virtually cut off. The thought of taking their baby into such an environment terrified her. She had pictured, to herself and aloud to Vic, sudden snowstorms blowing up, stranding him in Portland and her in Castle Rock. She thought and spoke of Tad swallowing pills in such a situation, or burning himself on the stove, or God knew what. And maybe part of her resistance had been a stubborn refusal to give up the excitement and hurry of New York. Well, face it, the worst hadn't been any of those things. The worst had been a nagging conviction that AdWorks would fail, and they would have to go crawling back with their tails between their legs. That hadn't happened, because Vic and Roger had worked their butts off. But that had also meant that she was left with a growing-up child and too much time on her hands. She could count her life's close friends on the fingers of one hand. She was confident that the ones she made would be her friends forever, come hell or high water— but she had never made friends quickly or easily. She had toyed with the idea of getting her Maine certification. Maine and New York were reciprocal. It was mostly a matter of filling out some forms. Then she could go see the superintendent of schools and get her name put on the sublist for Castle Rock High. It was a ridiculous notion, and she shelved it after running some figures on her pocket calculator. Gasoline and sitter's fees would eat up most of the $28 a day she might have made. "I've become the fabled great American housewife," she had thought dismally one day last winter, watching sleet spick and spack down against the porch storm windows. "Sitting home, feeding Tad his Franks and beans or his toasted cheese sandwiches and Campbell's soup for lunch. Getting my slice of life from Lisa on As the World Turns, and from Mike on The Young and the Restless. Every now and then, we jive it up with a Wheel of Fortune session." She could go over and see Joni Welsh, who had a little girl about Tad's age, but Joni always made her uneasy. She was 3 years older than Donna, and 10 pounds heavier. The extra 10 pounds did not seem to bother her. She said her husband liked her that way. Joni was contented with things as they were in Castle Rock. A little at a time, the shit had started to back up in the pipe. She started to sharpshoot at Vic about little things, sublimating the big things because they were hard to define and even harder to articulate. Things like loss and fear and getting older. Things like being lonely and then getting terrified of being lonely. Things like hearing a song on the radio that you remembered from high school and bursting into tears for no reason. Feeling jealous of Vic because his life was a daily struggle to build something. He was a knight-errant with a family crest embossed on his shield. And her life was back here, getting Tad through the day, jollying him when he was cranky, listening to his raps, fixing his meals, and